ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Connor will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime, Nate Geraci, alongside Connor Kelly. As always, thank you so much for joining us for what is actually our last show of 2018. No ETF Prime over the holidays, but I've got to tell you, we are closing out the year in style today. This is going to be a lot of fun. First up will be ETF.com's Laura Krieger. We have her 2019 ETF predictions in hand. These have not yet been published anywhere. You can only get them here. And she has some good ones. I would say maybe a couple you might suspect, but certainly a few that are going to surprise you. So Laura will be along here momentarily with those. We'll then be joined by Ben Johnson, Director of Global ETF Research at Morningstar. He's going to give us a quick recap of ETFs in 2018. We'll also hear a few of his ETF predictions for next year. And then we're going to put Ben through our ETF gauntlet today, our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. So we have a bunch of random ETF questions we're going to throw at Ben. He covers the ETF space as well as anyone, so that should be a lot of fun. We'll then close today with Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors. He's going to recap the financial markets this year and also look ahead to 2019. So, Connor, we'll recap the year that was in ETFs. We'll recap the financial markets. Look ahead to 2019 for both. Pretty good way to close out the year.
Real quick here, Nate, I do want to make a point about the year that ETFs have had in 2018. I mean, it's been a tough year in the financial markets. We talked about that in depth last week, but bonds, stocks, U.S., international, emerging markets, and most everything is down this year. But with all that being said, ETFs are still set to have their second best year of inflows ever. And I think that surprised some of the naysayers out there. Well, a lot of the growth of ETFs in the past, 5-7 years have obviously been in the midst of a huge bull market in the U.S. So a lot of, the anti-ETF people out there have been saying that the flows to ETFs are going to, collapse, slow down once the market cools off and, stock picking's back in favor and all these things that we always hear from active management. That hasn't been the case this year. And this was a hard year for investors with most asset classes being down. And when you look outside the U.S., a lot significant losses with a lot of equity internationally, but massive amounts of funds are still being invested into ETFs every day and every month. But anyways, back to your point, this year in show is always a good one, and we've got a lineup of three really great guests to send us out on a good note here in 2018.
All right. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can visit etfprime.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Nate Geraci and at CKelly1980. Let's start today with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Laura, so we have the grand unveiling of your 2019 ETF predictions today. I'm really excited to go through these. I've had an opportunity to take a look at what your crystal ball turned up. I think I like most of what you have here. I will say I was a bit surprised at a couple of your predictions, just knowing sort of your own personal feelings on these particular topics. But without further ado, let's just jump right in here. So your first prediction you call a gimme. And this is one I would say probably isn't going to surprise most people. You predict fee wars and ETFs will continue, including the very first zero-fee ETF. And as I'm sure you saw last week, there was a lot of speculation floating around that perhaps JP Morgan could be the one to launch the first free ETF. So give us your thoughts here. How do you think this goes down?
Sure, sure. So I think it is a gimme that we are going to see the fee wars continue because, you know, we saw so much of it happen in 2018. There were more than 150 ETFs that cut their expense ratios this year, and there's still plenty of room for expense ratios to be cut even further. The average equity ETF costs 54 basis points. The average smart beta ETF costs 52 basis points. You know, it may seem to an outside observer that, you know, ETFs have cut all the fees that they can, that they can't really go any farther, but they actually really can. So they can drop more. And as far as the zero-fee ETF goes, you know, like you said, there was some speculation about whether J.P. Morgan was going to be the one to launch the zero-fee fund. I can't predict whether that's going to be the case or not, but we do know that Fidelity's zero-fee mutual fund has been an absolute marketing boon for them. It's brought in over $2 billion since the funds launched in September, untold amounts more in terms of people who buy the funds and then get upsold to other, you know, higher margin products. So I really think it's only a matter of time before ETF issuers see that strategy and want to replicate it for their own products.
Yeah, and it does seem like either J.P. Morgan or Charles Schwab, those are really the two you hear is potentially launching a zero-fee ETF. Going back to your point on fees continuing to come down, you know, investors can obviously now get core exposure for a few basis points, right? 3-4 basis points. And I actually saw last week the head of ETFs for both Vanguard and iShares, they seem to make it pretty clear they're not going to offer free ETFs. So I guess expanding upon your prediction of fee wars continuing, do you mean everywhere else, you know, gold, thematic ETFs, factor-based, or do you think the Vanguards and iShares of the world, you know, will relent and we will see further fee reductions in core offerings from those types of providers?
I think that we're probably not going to see core U.S. equity ETFs drop their expense ratios pretty much farther. I mean, the ones that have been dropped, they're pretty low at this point. But there are a wealth of opportunities for places for funds to be cut in their expense ratios. Like you mentioned, gold ETFs. I was covering that earlier this month. We did kind of a roundup on what the expense ratio action that's been happening in the gold market. You know, physical gold ETFs, the least expensive one has gone from 40 basis points down to now 17 basis points. So you're going to see that sort of story play out everywhere, from gold to thematics to, you know, to bonds to emerging market bonds to all various quarters in the market. I think we're just going to see this continue.
All right, let's move on to your next prediction, and I'll say this one surprised me a little bit, though I think I'm coming around on this. You say there's not going to be a Bitcoin ETF in 2019. Now, to be honest, I'm still somewhat surprised we didn't see a Bitcoin ETF this year, just given that we do have a fully functioning Bitcoin futures market, although given what the price of Bitcoin has done, I'm sure the SEC is toasting champagne in their office that they didn't approve that. But why do you think no Bitcoin ETF in 2019?
Well, I think it's probably because, let's see, Hester Pierce, who's the SEC commissioner who's in favor of, you know, a Bitcoin ETF, there's been a lot of ink spilled on that. She is all about bringing new opportunities to the market, but she is just one SEC commissioner. The other commissioners have been a little bit more hesitant on, you know, whenever we have hearings on potential new ETFs and so on and so forth. And I think there's just too many unsettled questions about how the SEC would police a cryptocurrency product cryptocurrency as a rule trades on these overseas exchanges that are anonymous, completely anonymous, and with, you know, inconsistent record keeping that underpins each transaction. And that's not really an ocean that I see the SEC wanting to wade into. And you're right, the futures market have imposed some level of consistency and traceability and price discovery into the market, but there's actually still fairly little volume on these futures contracts, which I think is a further disincentive in the SEC's book towards greenlighting a Bitcoin fund.
Well, and I think even Hester Pierce, I saw she made some comments a few weeks ago pertaining to a crypto ETF. She said, don't hold your breath. It could come tomorrow or in 20 years. So clearly she's seeing the writing on the wall as well. All right, your next prediction, I'll say this does flat out surprise me. So you say we will see another marijuana ETF hit the market in 2019. Of course, right now, the only pure play option is the ETFMG, Alternative Harvest ETF, ticker MJ. I think I'm surprised by this one just because I know you've done a lot of research on the custodial issues here, how custodians are unwilling to support a marijuana ETF, right? They fear tripping over federal laws and losing their banking licenses. So what changes between now and the end of 2019?
So there are a number of interesting proposals out there now that could potentially address the custodian issue. I've covered a few of them on the site, one of which being using a broker-dealer to be the custodian of the fund instead of a large U.S. bank. And so that would kind of address some of the custodial risk in these funds, that being that banks can't legally hold marijuana stocks without risking their FDIC insurance and their banking license. But it really goes back to what I'm always saying whenever I come on here and talk about marijuana ETFs, which is that the big obstacle holding them back is legalization. Pot is just, it's just still not federally legal. I think after 2018's election cycle, however, there's been a bit of a political shift. The House of Representatives, going from Republican to Democratic control, coupled with the fact that Jeff Sessions, who is a noted anti-pot advocate, is now out as head of the Justice Department. So I think you're going to see sort of a movement in a positive direction towards legalization. We probably aren't going to see pot be legalized on a federal level this year, not without a different Senate and different president and all of that. But, who knows? We might see it kind of go back to the way, to the status it was in maybe 2016, 2015. Legalization would be an easy way for Congress to gain a little goodwill with a populace that very much wants marijuana to be legal. And certainly the business incentive is there. You see all of these companies that are testing the waters and making deals and mergers to explore opportunities in the marijuana space. I really do think it's just a matter of time. And maybe next year is the year.
Laura, let's say you're right and we do get a couple more pot ETFs on the market. Do you think there's enough investor interest to support multiple pot ETFs?
I do think there is. And I think the reason there is because there's some investor concern about the fund that is currently there. And I think even just one extra fund on the market would give those investors who may be a little reticent to invest in that fund, given the custodial risk associated with it, it would give them an alternative. There are always going to be people who want to invest in MJ. I think it's it's certainly an option, but more options on the market are better. And this is a space that has pent up demand. We see with the Horizons ETFs over in Canada, Horizons has two marijuana ETFs currently, actually maybe three. Their assets are remarkably sticky. Regardless of what the marijuana price does, these assets don't go anywhere, which to me suggests that there's huge pent-up demand for marijuana ETFs among investors.
We're visiting with ETF.com's Laura Krieger. We're going through her 2019 ETF predictions. All right, Laura, your next prediction, I would say this is the one that surprised me the most, just because you and I have debated this topic several times on the show this year. Now, I'm not saying I was right, but I got to tell you, I'm feeling a little bit better. So you predict ESG ETFs continue to underwhelm. Of course, ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. These are socially responsible ETFs. So why is that? Because my sense is you're a believer in the ESG approach to investing overall. What's the issue with ETFs?
Well, yeah, it does pain me. It kills me to have to make this prediction a little bit. I'm dying on the inside. And part of the reason is the fact that you right just now had to explain what ESG meant. I think that the acronym is not doing anybody any favors, and it is just this big elephant in the room that we can't get around, is this clunky acronym. But even setting that aside, in terms of net flows for the year, socially responsible ETFs actually ended 2018 pretty much in the same spot that they started it. There's about $7.7 billion in assets under management in total for the space, which is pretty much where we started 2018 from. So I just don't think that there has been enough price competition in this space or competitive performance to lure people away from the way that they've been doing the tried and true funds. And I think that those two factors are why advisors in particular aren't picking up ESG ETFs, even though maybe their clients want them to do so. There was a story in ThinkAdvisor, I think, yesterday or the day before, about how individual investors actually really want impact investments, but their advisors are sort of just shrugging their shoulders at it. And I think as long as ESG funds continue to be more expensive than vanilla funds, and they continue to just sort of offer middling, you know, maybe they outperform, maybe they don't, but it's a very middling sort of performance, you're not going to see the ESG space take off. Now, that kills me to say it, because I really do think that there is a hunger for these types of ETFs out on the market. Speaking with investors, you know, they want this. They want sustainable investing to succeed, but it's just not good enough yet. So.
Well, and I think, you know, we've been watching the two Vanguard ESG ETF offerings. I think these are a good proxy for whether or not the investor interests exist. These are, you know, pretty low cost, not as cheap as just plain vanilla index funds, but definitely low cost. And they have some assets, but they certainly haven't been lighting the world on fire. So I think those will be interesting watching moving forward. Laura, we're running a bit short on time here. I do want to get to one more of your predictions as it pertains to ETFs. You say we'll see many more launches of defined outcome ETFs, asset allocation ETFs, in alternative ETFs, but you say 95% won't get any traction with investors. Why is that?
Right. So I think these more sophisticated strategies are going to be the bulk of new launches from here on out, because core is done. You know, core equity funds, everybody's got one now. So this is where issuers really see that they can set themselves apart and they can establish themselves. But, you know, there's two drawbacks or two obstacles in the road for that. So the first obstacle is that these funds are from new issuers, and that means they don't have the name recognition of a Vanguard or an iShares or so on and so forth. So they're just going to struggle to gain market share from that reason alone. But secondly, lots of advisors that I speak to kind of pride themselves on coming up with an investment strategy for their clients. You know, they use ETFs like puzzle pieces to put together a strategy for their clients. And that's how they achieve alpha. That's how they add value. And so I'm not sure that these kinds of advisors are really going to want an all-in-one strategy, no matter how well it works, right? They'd rather sell their own smarts than somebody else's. And so I think that's another headwind for these sorts of defined outcome, target risk sophisticated strategy ETFs. They just do too much.
No, and I think especially on the asset allocation ETFs, I would say from an investor behavior standpoint, these things are probably wonderful. They'd probably be a great mousetrap for a lot of investors.
Right.
But I think to your point, an advisor doesn't want their client statement showing up with one holding on it. And so that's probably why they've been slow to catch on. Laura, we'll have to leave it there. Excellent job on the predictions. I am hoping to have my ETF predictions out here in the next week or so. So we might have to have a friendly wager on how many get right. Really appreciate your time today. Happy holidays. Look forward to connecting in 2019. Thank you.
Same to you both. Bye.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Morningstar's Ben Johnson. He'll recap the year that was in ETFs. He'll offer a few ETF predictions of his own. And then we're going to hit Ben with our rapid-fire ETF Q&A. This should be a lot of fun. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Connor in studio. Our next guest is Ben Johnson, Director of Global ETF Research at Morningstar. Of course, Morningstar is probably best known for their fund research, of which Ben heads up all of their exchange-traded fund research and coverage. He knows the ETF space inside and out, and we're very pleased to have him joining us via phone today from Chicago. Ben, great having you back on the program. It's been a little while.
It's been a while. We've had a Cubs World Series victory, I think, since we last spoke.
I think you're right. It's been, a couple of years? Well, Ben, I think we're doing this a bit backwards today. So we had ETF.com's Laura Krieger give us her ETF predictions for 2019. But I actually want to go back and have you give us a quick recap of ETFs in 2018. And then perhaps we can get a few of your ETF predictions as well. As you look back at the year that was in 2018, what were maybe two or three ETF stories that really stood out to you?
Yeah, so three stories really stand out to me. The first is that it's kind of a non-story, that what's driving growth in the ETF space isn't actually what's grabbing headlines. It's not Bitcoin, blockchain, robots, or marijuana. It's plain vanilla, dirt-cheap ETFs that continue to get most of investors' money. So if you look at the $275 billion in net new flows that we've seen this year, which is about to surpass 2016 in terms of the second most ever on an annual basis into ETFs, 63% of that $275 billion has gone into ETFs with fees less than 10 basis points, or 0.1%. And these ETFs are sort of the Swiss Army knives within the industry. They're well-built, multi-purpose tools that can do a lot of different jobs for a lot of different people. So if you look at an example like the iShares Core S&P 500 ETF, IVV, this fund can be a buy-and-hold core position for an individual investor, or it can be used in place of a futures contract by an institution. So the bigger and more diverse the ETF's user base, the greater the number of ways it can be used, the more powerful the network effect it will have, and the greater its growth will be. So these Swiss Army knife funds rarely get credit for all the good work they do for investors because they're very utilitarian, they're very unsexy, and they're rarely the ones that grab the headlines.
Ben, on this topic of dirt cheap ETFs, you know, I think without question, one of the biggest investment stories in 2018 was Fidelity taking fees to zero, right? Offering four index mutual funds at no cost. And we talked earlier in the show about whether we might see a zero fee ETF at some point. I guess the question I have, no question that this has benefited investors, but does it really matter at this point? You know, how much do you think investors care if they're paying nothing or three basis points for core exposure?
Yeah, it matters less as fees get closer and closer to zero, or in the case now of four Fidelity index mutual funds have actually reached zero. So no fee, no ongoing management fee for those funds. So going from 50 basis points, 0.5%, to 5 basis points is something really to celebrate. Pop out the champagne, you know, invite your friends over. When you go from 5 basis points to 3 or 3 to 0, your incremental gains are less and less. Your incremental savings are less and less. So going from 3 bips to 0 bips on a $10,000 investment saves you $3 a year, which sure is great. Every little helps. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, most of the major victories as far as expense ratios are concerned have already been won.
All right. So you mentioned you had three ETF stories from 2018. Give us the other two.
Yeah. So the other one I think that is relatively undertold or under the radar is another factor that's becoming an increasingly important driver of ETF growth. And that's the rise of what I'll call ETF model builders. So these are model portfolios that are built using ETFs exclusively, and they're being assembled by a wide variety of market participants. So these model builders might include RIAs. They could be home office teams at big wirehouses like Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley. They could be the so-called robo-advisors, and even increasingly, the ETF sponsors themselves. So if you look at the ETF sponsors, what you see is that they're moving away from selling slices to selling whole pies. So they're more and more so building model portfolios that are typically made using their own ETFs exclusively, and they're delivering those directly to clients through a number of different channels. So I think the most interesting data point that confirmed this trend in 2018 was the growth we saw in State Street's lineup of SPDR portfolio ETFs. These are ETFs that they launched late last year, and these firms have a prime seat at the table on TD Ameritrade's commission-free ETF list, so they can be used on an a la carte basis by advisors who custody with TD and build their own ETF models, or they can be bought in a bundle off the shelf in a prepackaged model that's built by State Street themselves. So I think the rise of the model builders and model builders of all stripes that are using what are effectively, you know, if you think of ETFs as building blocks or Legos, you know, you can buy a kit or you can play master builder and kind of go freestyle and build something on your own, given that you've got every different type of brick you could possibly want to deliver every type of different outcome you could possibly imagine.
So as we look ahead now to 2019, are there any ETF predictions or anything else ETF related you'll be watching for?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is ultimately going to hinge on what happens in the markets. And as far as that's concerned, we frankly have no idea. The one thing that we continue to keep a close eye on is what's going on with respect to regulation. So we've got the SEC rule that's being mulled, right, or the ETF rule, rather, that's being mulled by the SEC. So they've sought comment from the market. We've submitted our own comments on that. You know, I think that's a rule that's long overdue. You know, the SEC is effectively now, you know, trying to build an eggshell around a fully grown chicken that hatched back in 1993. but nonetheless, I think an important move forward for investors. I think it's also important to keep an eye on what might happen with respect to consolidation, consolidation in the industry amongst either index providers, the ETF sponsors themselves, who increasingly are the largest shareholders of some of the largest publicly traded companies in the world. And that has important implications for corporate governance, a whole host of different issues that are coming under increasing scrutiny from academics, from regulators, from the industry at large. So something else to keep a close eye on is this industry continues to grow, I think, far beyond what anyone may have expected, certainly if you were to go back, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Ben, one of the proposals as part of the ETF rule is better labeling for exchange-traded products, right? So calling commodity-based products ETCs, leverage products ETI, exchange-traded investments. How much do you think that might help investors better understand what they're investing in?
I think better labeling is long overdue. I think the ETF sort of brand gets thrown around in the same way Kleenex is used to refer to all different types of facial tissue. And what we know is that not every tissue is a Kleenex. Not everything that's called an ETF is actually a 1940 Act fund. And there are certain investor protections. There are certain sort of terms, especially if you cross the divide into the realm of exchange-traded notes, that are far less investor friendly than what you might expect from a fund proper. So, you know, more broadly, when you think about exchange traded products, I think more granular labeling, more transparent and consistent labeling to help investors know when they've sort of crossed that border from ETFs into something different would certainly help investors to avoid sort of any nasty, unexpected surprises that they might encounter.
Our guest is Ben Johnson, Director of Global ETF Research at Morningstar. All right, Ben, so with the remaining time we have, we have started a new tradition on this show where anytime we visit with a well-rounded ETF expert such as yourself, we'd like to close with a rapid-fire ETF Q&A. So I'll toss out a question. You just answer it however you see fit. We'll try to burn through as many of these as we can. So if you're ready, I'm going to start firing away here.
Let's do it.
All right. So we'll get the obvious one out of the way first. I have to start with Bitcoin ETFs. I'm guessing you're probably as worn out on this topic as everyone else is. But since I have asked this of, seemingly, you know, every guest we've had on the show this year, I've got to close out the year by doing the same with you. Should there be a Bitcoin ETF?
No. I think the only people who want Bitcoin ETFs are the people who already own Bitcoin outside of an ETF and want a sucker to sell their Bitcoin to. If anything, having a Bitcoin ETF might make it harder to own Bitcoin. I could probably, you know, buy some Bitcoin right now on the line with you, Nate, and download an app and move some money around quicker than I could invest in a Bitcoin ETF. So I don't see the same sort of convenience case as you have with something like gold. I don't see any need for a Bitcoin ETF.
All right. Your favorite new ETF of 2018, with our usual disclaimer, this isn't an investment recommendation, just an ETF launch you found particularly interesting or compelling.
Yeah. So the Vanguard Multi-Factor ETF is the most compelling ETF I've seen brought to the market to date. So this is an interesting approach to building a multi-factor portfolio, one that sort of ups the octane in terms of the underlying factor exposures, chiefly because it goes further down the market cap spectrum into smaller cap stocks where factors tend to be more potent. And it's nominally active, so it's kind of a paint-by-numbers active strategy that allows it to be a bit more sort of sensible in terms of how it turns the portfolio over to manage the balance between performance and cost.
Yeah, no doubt. Obviously, it's in the mold of the traditional low-cost Vanguard approach. On the topic of new ETF launches, I'm guessing you saw a vegan ETF will be launching in January. And, you know, what's interesting about this is the way they're marketing this product is by saying investors will avoid funding the slaughter of 13 animals a year for every $1,000 invested. The question I have is this the approach ESG ETFs need, sort of guilt investors into submission?
Yeah, I think speaking on your behalf, maybe, Nate, as a guy from Chicago and a guy from Kansas City, when you hear a vegan ETF from, you know, two cities with proud heritages and all things meat related, that was a bit of a record scratch moment. And, you know, while I think the idea is, you know, interesting, I think what is most interesting about it is that, you know, ESG investors, you know, want to know, pardon the reference here, but where's the beef? So where is the actual impact in terms of how this ESG strategy is aligning with my values? So I think the more that sponsors of ESG funds can bring to bear real reliable data that shows, yes, you've saved this many cows and this many chickens or recycled these many gallons of water, I think the more likely you're going to have uptake, the more likely you're going to have buy-in from prospective investors.
All right. So also on the topic of ETF launches, there was an ETF launched by WisdomTree earlier this year that was inspired by a Twitter conversation, which I just love because I think this highlights the innovation in ETFs. So I thought you and I could try to do the same here on ETF Prime. Is there an ETF that doesn't exist that you would like to see launched?
There's an idea, a kernel of an idea that I have. So when you think about some of the ETFs that we really like, that we rate very highly, be they dividend ETFs or share buyback ETFs or just shareholder yield ETFs, what you see is a lot of those funds require a long history of paying and growing dividends or returning cash to shareholders. So my nugget of an idea is kind of an emerging shareholder return aristocrats ETF. So when you think of companies like Apple that only began paying a dividend and has subsequently grown its dividend and returned capital to shareholders through buybacks as well, going back to only 2012, they fail to meet certain criteria that you've got in things like the Vanguard Dividend Appreciation ETF. You've gotten the Schwab Dividend Equity ETF, SCHD. So if there was a way to sort of capture rising companies that are beginning to, you know, deliver more and more return by returning cash to shareholders, I think there might be something there.
I think I like that one. I think we're going to have to get that one filed, Ben. You know, on the topic of just thinking through intellectual property in an ETF, you know, one of the things that I think is coming to the forefront is you have these smaller entrepreneurial ETF firms that come up with great ideas. And if they're successful, you may see some of the larger firms come in and effectively replicate that idea and maybe do it in a lower cost manner since they have the scale and the distribution. Does that give you any concern at all? Just that you really can't protect intellectual property in the, you know, in the underlying index. Obviously, somebody can't rip it off verbatim, but you can take the core of the idea and put it in, you know, whatever, a lower cost wrapper. I guess, do you think that has the potential to stifle ETF innovation at all?
Well, I think that's just reflective of just how hyper competitive this space is, to be honest, and it cuts multiple directions. So, you know, if you look at, say, the Fidelity Zero Fund, the total U.S. market fund, you know, that tracks a Fidelity index that, for all intents and purposes, is Fidelity's version of the Russell 3000. So I think to the extent that, as far as the end investor is concerned, it can deliver a quality product, and in some cases, potentially a higher quality product at a lower cost, I'm not as concerned by that. Now, obviously, that looms large for the sponsors, many of whom are smaller upstarts trying to chip away at the stranglehold the incumbents have on this marketplace. You know, that, if I were one of those firms, would be something that would keep me up at night, because the competition is just brutally fierce.
All right, we only have about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to go really rapid fire through these last few.
All right.
Worst mistake an ETF investor can make?
Using market orders in times of tumult. So we've seen this time and time again. We've seen it in flash crash, and especially, you know, orders that turn into market orders, like stop loss orders. ETF investors can get burned when it comes to transacting in ETFs. It's important to respect what the ET stands for, and to use limit orders. If you use limit orders, you're going to get the price you want or better, and you don't have to worry about an unfortunate situation where you get a price that you definitely do not want.
Your biggest concern surrounding ETFs, anything that maybe keeps you up at night?
I think it's related to what we were just talking about in terms of trading, and it's the other sort of links in the ETF ecosystem, and you know, just the health of the authorized participants and market makers who are toiling away all day, every day, to make orderly markets, to quote good prices in ETFs. There are certain market environments where that becomes more challenging. You know, fortunately, 99.999% of the time, they do really, really good work on behalf of millions of investors.
All right, then lastly, what has you most excited about the future of ETFs?
The thing that excites me most is just how democratizing of force ETFs have been on the investment landscape, and what it means in particular for the smallest investors, you know, who can now get institutional caliber portfolios, institutional level pricing, by investing very small sums of money to save for their retirement, to save for their kids' college, you name it. I think 20 years from now we'll look back at that and just, you know, be astonished at just how meaningful that was for such a huge spectrum of investors that, you know, otherwise had been sort of subject to investing in very high cost funds and being sort of churned and burned by advisors. I think it's a wonderful thing for a large number of small investors.
Ben, before we let you go, I do have one bonus question for you.
All right.
I know you're a Chicago Bears fan. Of course, we're here in KC. We now have the savior, Patrick Mahomes. Will we see a Chicago KC Super Bowl?
We're going to see a Chicago KC Super Bowl. And if I had to make a prediction, I would say the final score would be Bears 16, Chiefs 3. I'm going to work in a Khalil Mack safety in there.
You have a lot of faith in that defense.
And an Eddie Jackson pick six into my 16.
Well, I will say, if my recollection serves me correct, when we had you on the show a few years ago, you did mention how the Chicago Cubs were up and coming, and obviously that proved correct. So we'll see what happens here. I don't know that the Chicago defense can hold KC to three, but I think it'd be a lot of fun to watch. Ben, really enjoyed having you back on the program. This was just a lot of fun. Happy holidays to you and your family. Thank you.
Thanks. Happy holidays, guys.
That was Ben Johnson, Director of Global ETF Research at Morningstar. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll close the show this year by recapping the financial markets and looking ahead to 2019. We'll be joined by iSector's Chief Investment Officer, Chuck Self. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime, Nate and Connor in studio. We're now very pleased to be joined by Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors, who manages a suite of 16 ETF-based asset allocation strategies. These have over $250 million invested in them. And Chuck is a seasoned veteran of the financial markets, over 30 years of experience in investment management. Chuck is joining us via phone today from Appleton, Wisconsin. Chuck, great having you back on the show.
It's great to be with you.
Well, Chuck, you have the fortune or perhaps misfortune of being our final guest of 2018. And I say misfortune because you get to recap the financial markets. And
great.
Obviously, it's been a challenging year. Just about every major asset class is negative. Before we get into some of the details here, is there another year you would compare this to? Is this reminiscent of any other time period over your 30 years in the financial markets?
Well, I started in investment markets in 1980 professionally, so I have seen a lot. But unfortunately, we've never had the case since 1980 where we had both the stock market and the bond market down. So there's never been a year quite like this one. The closest would be 2005, I believe, where you had the valuations had come off as far as forward-looking PEs. But we had seen aggressive Fed, you know, at that point it was more aggressive than today, but, you know, a relatively aggressive Fed. And also we saw commodities, especially oil prices, come up from the lows of the previous few years. If it is 2005, then that means that whatever we're going through now is probably just a market correction, and that we'll run back to the highs of September. Sometime next year. But I also have to say that there is a significant probability that it's 2007, and that would be bad news, of course, if that's the case.
Chuck, if we look at returns, and these are all year-to-date through the end of last week, large-cap U.S. stocks are slightly negative, down about 1%. Small-cap U.S. stocks are down nearly 8%. Developed international and emerging market stocks are both down around 13%. Gold is down 5%. As you touched on, even broad-based bonds, so something like the Bloomberg Barclays Ag, that's down a percent or two, which doesn't happen very often for the entire year. Most other segments of the bond market are negative as well. So, you know, look, for a diversified investor, they're probably down a few percent. But I do think it's important to point out this hasn't been a 25 or 30% drawdown. How much fear in the markets right now do you think is just because this environment is different than what we've experienced over the past several years?
Well, they're always different, and we have a new set of investors coming in all the time, so they don't remember the past. One of the things about 2005 was that we were going through this real estate boom, which we haven't had any sort of boom. Yeah, you could talk about some bubbles like the cryptocurrency bubbles and maybe the FANG bubbles, but it wasn't anything like the real estate bubbles as far as how many people participated in it. But the other thing that that people have missed, especially about the bond market, is that the index that you looked at, the Barclays aggregate index, has become much more volatile than it ever has been. The average maturity is longer than 7 years now. It hasn't been that long for a very long period of time. And so, as you know, with interest rates going up, prices go down, and the longer your maturities, the more volatility you have. If the volatility of the Barclays Ag was where it had been, let's say, in 2005, then the interest payments that you would have received would have been more than the capital loss that you received. All this is to say that if you had been, if you had not had exposure to the bond index, which in our opinion is a terrible way to invest in bonds, but had been shorter, you actually would have positive returns. You wouldn't have big positive returns for that part of the portfolio, but at least you'd have positive returns, and that would have saved you somewhat from the stock decline. But you are correct that most diversified portfolios probably had negative returns. And you know, this is so unusual that you've got to think there's going to be some sort of regression to the mean next year, and we think that portfolios are going to be single-digit positive next year.
Well, Chuck, let's talk a little bit more about next year. What are some things that you think could be key market drivers? What will you be watching for?
Well, there's the first one, of course, is another reason why this is a bad timing to have me on here is that tomorrow the Fed's going to determine what they're going to say and what they're going to do. I think the vast majority of people believe that they're going to raise interest rates another 25 basis points. The question is, what are they going to say? And our view is that they are going to be very measured in how they decrease their thoughts about how many Fed interest rate hikes they're going to do next year. In the last meeting that had in September that had a press conference afterwards, they said that they think there's going to be three interest rate hikes in 2019. We think they're going to say there's going to be two in 2019. If they went down to one or none, the market is going to take that as the Fed knows something that we don't know, and it's going to really tank the market. I think if they say two, then the market is going to be fine as far as that's concerned. And then in March, they could say one, and then if things don't turn around by June, they could say we're not going to do anymore. Our base forecast is that the Fed is going to, that this is the last interest rate increase in this cycle. The economy is slowing faster than people expect. The tax cuts that were implemented have truly been a one-time event because it most of the savings didn't go into manufacturing or infrastructure, whatever. They went to shareholders, and so there's not much left for the tax cuts. We have the lag effects of the Fed rate increases we've talked about, and then even the wealth effects of this down market will have an impact. And so our view is that the economy will still have positive returns, you know, have positive growth next year, but it's going to probably slow down faster than people expect. We don't expect a recession to 2020, but there's certainly a more than one-third chance that it's going to start in the fourth quarter of next year.
Chuck, we're running a bit short on time. We only have about 2 minutes left here. Besides the Fed, I think obviously trade is something that's gotten a lot of attention, particularly with China. How important do you think that is to the outlook moving forward?
Well, again, it comes down to psychology. The market is all about psychology. I hear people say, well, the economy is so good and inflation is so low, that means the stock prices have to continue to go up or have to rebound big time. And that's not the case. It has to do with psychology. If we continue to have trade as a problem going forward as far as being in the news and so on, that's going to help cast a pall on the market and make people think that economic growth next year is going to be relatively small. So We are hoping that the trade situation gets resolved some way or another in the next few months so that we could just continue to focus on the good earnings and relatively low interest rates.
Well, Chuck, we'll have to leave it there. Always appreciate you joining us on the program. Look forward to connecting again in the new year. Happy holidays to you and your family. Thank you.
And same to you.
That was Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors. And you can learn more about their ETF strategies by visiting iSectors.com. Connor, this Fed meeting tomorrow, I'm going to be interested to watch this because, you know, we don't sit here and try to read the tea leaves. Mm-hmm. That's not what we do on this show. But I feel like they're a bit in a no-win situation because if they don't raise rates, investors may perceive that as the Fed having some real concerns about the economy. Of course, if they do raise rates, there's going to be concerns about, you know, what that does to the economy. So they're a bit boxed in here. And, you know, I've said before that I think the Fed did a remarkable job navigating the financial crisis, right? I thought they were darn near perfect. But I do feel like now they may have finally made a policy error in getting a bit too aggressive in raising rates and reducing their balance sheet. So this will be interesting to watch. I think Chuck's right. The language is going to be key here.
Well, President Trump's tweets aren't helping the situation. I mean, he tweeted out this morning. He tweeted out Monday morning, vehemently opposed to a rate increase. And the Fed is supposed to be independent, right? And we've never seen a president be this, I think, vocal in his opposition of what the Fed is certainly planning on doing. So tomorrow's going to be fascinating because you're right, Nate. If they do pause, I think that's actually going to scare the market more than if they do raise rates as has been forecasted for the entire year. But that is what Trump is really publicly pushing for, and it's put Jerome Powell and the Fed in a really tough spot.
Well, you mentioned Trump's tweets. You know, that's the other thing we didn't talk about with Chuck. We were running short on time, is just the political environment. You wonder if the Mueller investigation or Democrats taking the House will have any sort of impact on the markets. We'll have to leave it there. Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at ETFPrime.com, ETF.com, iTunes, and Spotify. Just a reminder, no podcasts the next 2 weeks. Our next show will be January 8th. And we'll kick off 2019 with two excellent guests for you. Michael Strain, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. They're a big think tank in Washington, D.C. He'll join us to talk both the economy and the political landscape in 2019. And then Christian Magoon, always one of our favorite guests. He's founder of Amplify ETFs. He'll spotlight their Black Swan Growth and Treasury ETF, along with a few other ETFs they offer. Until then, thank you everyone for listening this year. Really appreciate it. Happy holidays. Look forward to seeing you in 2019.